It is unquestionably the same Madeline they tossed away with the body of the thirdborn. But who has retrieved it? Chindelin? Eshet? And why have they carried it all this way, only to abandon it here?
Bait, says Mektu. Someone determined that the ice was weak and tossed it out there.
And the Tirmasil couldn't resist, says Khandri. That's my guess, too. But did it help them escape? And how far could they possibly get, blind in this heat? For that matter, how far are we going to get? We're in trouble, Mektu. We're sweating our lives away.
Careful, says Mektu. Here's the shore.
It is a great relief to stand on solid ground at last. They drop their packs, sip from a fosca, then shout for the others again. At first, Khandri thinks he hears a distant answering voice, but a moment later there is nothing but the low scrape of the wind. He tells his brother to make a quick search along the shore, leaving him with their belongings. Mektu agrees. They both know how much faster he'll be without a blind man on his arm.
10 minutes north, 10 south, he says. If I don't find them, maybe I'll at least find some kind of shelter. In any case, I won't let you out of my sight.
Just hurry, says Khandri. I'm not going anywhere.
Ha! That's a safe bet.
Khandri looks at him, or rather turns his head as if looking. His brother's laughter ceases.
I'll be quick, he says, and is gone.
20 minutes later, he returns and swigs from the fosca.
Nothing, he says. Absolutely nothing.
And without another word, he runs south. Khandri sits under his headscarf, brooding. They must find shelter. The water won't suffice. And yet they cannot abandon Eshet and Chindelin. And Talupeke. Was there any chance of finding her alive? Would she just try to kill them if they did? Poor fucked-up soldier girl. Nerves shattered and dreams full of death. Callous gods or sleeping. Beaten bitch of a world. He knows why such savage thoughts are flooding him. Blindness, in a word. He is scared to death. What if it doesn't wear off in an hour, in a day? What if it lasts forever?
You're dying of thirst, Khandri Hingeman. Forever is the last thing you should be worrying about.
Khandri leaps up, hand on his machete.
Who's there?
He shouts.
Utter silence.
He draws the machete, recalling how quiet a Tau managed to be when it suited him. No one attacks, however, and the minutes drag on. Was the voice in his head? He laughs at himself. Of course it was in his head. Where else? But he knows the voices his thoughts come clothed in. His father's, his second mother's, Arikina's, his own. And that voice is not among them. It is a stranger's voice, one he has never heard before. Mektu is gone much longer this time. When at last he returns, he is gasping and stinking of sulfur mud.
What happened? Asks Khandri. Did you see them? Did you find anything?
Mektu collapses beside him, presses an object into his hands. It is a small, mud-caked shoe.
Eshets,
he says, spitting out the word. He is struggling not to cry. He says that the shoe lay on the ice in the middle of a turquoise pool. No footprints. The blowing grit erased them all too quickly. But at one end of the pool, the ice was shattered. Mektu had leaped in, searching. He'd found nothing at all.
That doesn't mean she's drowned, says Khandri. You waded out of there, didn't you?
His brother says nothing. Khandri gropes for his shoulder.
I know how to get us out of the sun, he says. I don't know why I didn't think of it before.
He sketches the plan. Mektu sits like a stump. But for all his misery, he does not wish to die, and a moment later they are both on their feet. They walk the shore until Mektu spies one of the harmless, light-green pools. As Khandri waits, he sets to smashing the crystal surface. Then, working together, they drag 2 enormous ice sheets ashore, trim them roughly into squares, and plaster them with mud. Finally, with much swearing and staggering, they prop the squares against each other, forming a tall triangle.
Good and dark on the inside,
says Mektu. Scoop out the floor, Khan. I'll build a windbreak so we're not drowned in grit. Soon they are both in the shelter, lying side by side. Then the loss falls on Khandri like an avalanche. Uncle Chindalin, who guarded them in secret. Eshet, Talupeke. Clumsily, he recites a prayer for their safekeeping. But why, gods? I don't love you. I don't trust you. You'll do exactly as you like. And Mektu crosses and uncrosses his wrists in the gesture of holy release. Khandri makes the gesture too, the shackles of hell torn asunder by the eagle of Selulahi, one of the great tales of Uroth. Then Mektu begins to describe Eshet's ineptness at fellatio, and Khandri tells him to shut the fuck up.
What's wrong? Asks Mektu. I didn't complain. I never made her feel bad. I thought you might be interested, that's all.
You fuck her.
She's probably dead.
Mektu falls silent. Khandri's hands are in fists.
Just wait. Count the seconds. 8, 9, 10.
I'm not actually concerned with what she did to my dick, says Mektu. It's the broader picture that's interesting. Some girls just can't. Doesn't matter how you ask for it. You could draw a diagram, you could send them to dick-sucking school, but others get it right the first time. Arikina, for instance.
Khandri grabs his own wrist. He is that close to striking his brother in the face.
You can be such an evil bastard, he says. I have every right to talk about her, Khandri. We were in love. We were engaged to be married. Goat shit. You weren't. It's true. You don't know everything. We'd be married already if she hadn't disappeared.
She never slept with you. She probably never even kissed you. You dream shit up and then start to believe it.
Mektu answers by humming a tune. For a moment, Khandri simply cannot believe his ears. Then he elbows Mektu sharply.
So what? He says. You know that song, so what? You and everyone else in the valley. What does that have to do with Arikina?
You know.
I know you're about to get your ass kicked like never before.
Mektu gives an odd little laugh. Khandri's arms are rigid, his heart pounding, his uniform drenched in wasteful sweat. The song is nothing special, of course, except to a few hayseed chilotos from the valley, except to him. Grant me one last hour with my true love, and keep your cold forever. I'll praise eternal life above her golden kisses, never. The year is spent, the season chill, our heads are bowed in sorrow, but in the hearth's an ember still to light a fair tomorrow. If she's yet with me come the dawn, I'll live but for her smile, and bid 100 years be gone before I stray a mile. And if I forfeit heaven's joys in barter for that hour, in darkest hell I'll raise my voice and sing of love's last flower. What temple fair, what holy place, a sweeter secret's tending, than how we might in love's embrace go rowdy to our ending. A song for closing down the tavern, arms around one's mates. Also a song for lovers, obviously. The old man had sung it for their mother once, thinking himself alone with her, while Khandri and Mektu lay 8 feet above on the porch roof, astonished. Years later, Khandri sang it to Arikina, and they too had thought themselves alone. It was on one of their walking trysts, through the meadows above Blind Stream. Very late, that particular night, and the season chill indeed. All the same, they had held each other, laughed. Ari twisted the copper ring she had placed on his thumb just the day before, and he had found himself singing that song. They left the trail and climbed to a level place. Ari spread the blanket and rolled about like a schoolgirl, flattening the thigh-high grass. The place smelled vaguely of goats, but it didn't matter. Nothing mattered. It was only their third time in life. She stripped everything from him but the copper ring. He drew his coat over both of them, and what magic he learned of a woman's pleasures then. Of joys more elusive and harder earned, but earthquake deep when they came. She had loved the song, impossible romantic Arikina, and he, desperate to call the earthquake, thought, "Well, Condri, if your tongue can sing." For his exhausted member was no help. It became a bystander long before her hands tightened in his hair, and her head thrashed, and one clear cry escaped her and flew over the valley, like the whoop of some free heretic, the last unorthodox passion east of the sea. They were alone, yes, but when they descended to Blindstream Village, Mektu was waiting. He hadn't moved. He was still prowling the road where they had given him the slip. Arikina panicked, dragged Condri back into the shadows, one hand over his mouth. It was her iron rule. Mektu must not learn of their union.
"He's too loving," she told Condri. "Too loving and too fragile. He would never forgive us."
"One day he'll have to find out."
"Yes, one day. If you and I still—"
"But Ari," he interrupted. That was the if he would never contemplate. "Mektu's living in a dream world. This thing with you, this thing between you, it's all in his head." Ari had laughed at that.
"Where else does love live, Condri? In a milk jug? In a song?"
She demanded his word, and Condri gave it, never to tell, never to crush his brother with the truth.
"Don't strike him where he's weak, love. You'll never forgive yourself, and you'll lose your brother, too."
Condri was jealous of her affection for Mektu. He was jealous when a fly brushed her arm, but also humbled. More than anyone, Arikina saw the good in his brother and drew it out. Mektu volunteered at her clinic. He cleaned the bedpans, swapped jokes with invalids as he swabbed the drool from their faces, sat up playing cards with addicts in voluntary lockdown, chattering to keep their minds off wax or sky seed or brandy. Condri was a more dependable volunteer, but it was Mektu the patients loved. There were mishaps. He brought hallucinogenic foxberries for the addicts once.
"They looked so bored, Arikina."
True enough, but the second addict he approached had snatched the bag and guzzled handfuls of berries, and spent the next week talking to his thumbs. There were lost keys, outraged nurses. There was the night Mektu was sent to retrieve a package of bedsheets and surgical gowns from the station house in Bittermoon, and was found hours later in the Warhorse Tavern, snoring, the purse entrusted to him gone. After that incident, Arikina had not spoken to Mektu for 2 months, but he had repented and worked harder, and she had forgiven him at last. She loved his brother, and Condri knew he loved Mek as well, in glum confusion. Keeping him ignorant of their trysts, however, was far from enough. People talked, and Mektu talked incessantly. They had to hide their love from everyone in order to hide it from him. "We sneak around like criminals," Condri complained. Arikina just smirked at him.
"Like lovers, you mean?"
That was true enough. In earlier times, lovers in the Satapre had been left alone, provided they were discreet. But with the rise of Orthodox revelation, discreet was fast becoming clandestine. Soldiers passed through Blindstream every third or fourth day. There were barracks in Stone Gate and Wolfkill, and the various constables, aldermen, barristers, and magistrates all answered to military superiors. The resulting changes in valley life were profound, but not instantaneous. Human nature changed more slowly than institutions or rulers. In the shadows, things went on as before. Couples met, stripped, made love, made promises. By daylight, they did not even hold hands. So, the long way home. A stumbling walk through the dark meadows above the village, over wooden stiles and bridges over the deep-cut streams. Condri didn't mind. They were together that much longer, and at the last bridge, they crept down to the stream's edge and splashed their faces, their necks, each other, and she guided his wet hand beneath her shirt and arched her back.
"What you did tonight, oh darling, what if I can't think of other things? What if I want it all the time?"
"I do," he said.
I hadn't noticed.
She laughed and reached for him.
What do you think about when I'm touching you? Do your thoughts race everywhere, like mine?
He must have answered her. He could not have just sat there on the stones, lost in her hand's magic, breathing like a bull.
The closer you brought me, she said, the more my mind flew away into the night. I could see the whole world. I was on the God's mountain, looking down on us and the clinic and the valley all the way to the sea. I was happy and so terribly sad. Condry, what do you want to see before you die?
The desert, he told her, for he had known it for years. The deep desert, the great dunes, the stars at night reaching down to the sand. What do you want to see?
You know already, she said.
Kasralis.
Yes.
To find your Dr. Sirim.
She told me a secret, Condry. A beautiful secret. Their work could change the world.
Spread the blanket, he said.
I'll go to that city one day, when it's time to leave the valley.
The blanket, he repeated. Then, I'll go with you, to Kasralis, or anywhere you like.
Do you know, she said, I almost believe you would.
Condry wakes in their shelter of salt ice and mud, and lifts the bandage from one eye. His heart soars. Thank you, Ong All-Merciful. It's not much, a brown blur, his left hand, but he will take it. He can see. And when he crawls out into the red light of dusk, there is another blur that is his brother, kneeling with his arms around a woman's legs. Condry staggers close, squinting like some ancient grandfather.
It is Eshet, beautiful Eshet,
footsore and indescribably filthy.
Stop that, she says to Mektu. Give me something to eat.
Underneath her tattered canute, she looks like a ghoul. She has spent 5 hours standing chin-deep in green mud, hiding from the heat and the sun. Eyes clenched shut, more mud slapped on head and face, her bag lying near her on the ice, wind-blown grit filling her ears.
I kept nodding off. I'd wake up sinking, my mouth and nose full of mud.
How's your vision? Condry asks.
Better for the rest, but still awful. Togra, I hate this place.
As the brothers guessed, she had used the Madeglin as bait, luring the bald man out onto the ice against his better judgment.
I slid it out across a pool and kept going. He was so close, and I was nearly blind. I didn't stop until I heard the crack.
And it was you who took the blade off O'Julon's body, says Condry. You've had it all along. Eshet nods.
I thought it would help me get back to my village, to start over and forget the camp. I thought I'd hide it for a month or two and then slip away from the whorehouse and sell it on the road. You don't have to tell me how hard that would have been.
Condry steps close to her and takes both her hands. What I have to tell you, he says, is that I'm glad you're alive. She pulls back a little, startled by his fervor. Mektu, still on his knees, is even more so.
I kept your shoe, he grumbles.
When she makes no answer, he nudges Condry with his elbow.
Stop fondling her. Tell him, Eshet. Tell him about Chindlin and the girl.
What, you've seen them? Cries Condry.
When? Where? Midday, says Eshet. They were running east. Talupeke was still crazy, wailing like a cat. Chindlin was running after her, trying to calm her down. They went right past me. I shouted, but the girl just stabbed the air with her knife, and Chindlin covered his ears. Maybe he thought he was going crazy, hearing voices from a pool. He was nearly blind, after all. In any case, he kept after her, begging and pleading. Girl, Talupeke, girl! He even called her trouble. She didn't stop.
They must have run out of water hours ago, says Mektu. If they're sane enough to stop and drink, I mean. And if they haven't lost their packs.
Chindlin had his pack, and the bow, too, says Eshet. Not the girl, though. She was carrying nothing but her knives. Condry tries to picture them out there and shudders, hating what he sees. They won't live through tomorrow. We have to find them, and we have to start now. The others instantly agree. But as they make ready to depart, Condry feels a deep ache in his chest. Find them. The idea is almost laughable. Two half-blind people, led by a third squinting through darkened glass, searching a wilderness, marching into the night.
I'll lead you until it's pitch black, says Mektu. Condry, keep your bandage on. Heal those fucking eyes. If I catch you peeking, I'll say the kinds of things you hate.
You will anyway, says Condry. He ties one end of his headscarf to Mektu's belt and puts the middle of the scarf in Eshet's hand. The other end he holds tight himself.
That's good, says Mektu. But keep your distance and mind my shins. Ready, ducklings?
At first, the going is easy. They fall into a rhythm almost at once, and Mektu steers around the rare hole or obstacle in the scree. Condry is surprised at his own confidence, the headlong way he lunges forward, the trust he still grants his brother, somehow. For a time, they even break into a shuffling run. But more than ever, he feels the hopelessness of it all. Chindalin and Talupeke might have changed direction again. And even if they were sane enough to try to hold eastward, how could they? Even for Mektu, it is growing harder as the hills fade from view. Their lost comrades could be 10 miles off course, or even farther. If we could fan out, cast a wider net. But they cannot fan out. They are playing darts in a room with the lamps extinguished, not even certain they are facing the target, and anything but the bullseye losing the game. They shout and shout, but no answer comes. The wind whips their voices away like flakes of ash. The light dims. Mektu begins to stumble and swear. Somewhere on high they hear the scream of an ornak, angry and forlorn. The plane begins to climb. Mektu, amazed, reports signs of life. Bulbous cacti sprouting from hillocks of earth, tufts of wiry grass. Condry, too, is stunned. They have seen no vegetation since Belanger.
Stop crowding me, says Mektu. My eyes are in bad shape, too, and those cacti have more spines than a fishhook tree.
They slow to a walk and fare better, but then the night grows deeper still.
No good, says Mektu at last. I'm as blind as you are now. Until the moon comes up, we'll have to creep along like grannies, and not Talupeke's granny, either. I don't believe she learned knife-throwing from some old woman, do you? No, she must have taught herself. She must have natural talent. Condry and I were just talking about natural talent, weren't we?
Provocation, that's the word, Condry thinks. And should they find two dead bodies waiting for them? More provocation. More sly little stings. 2 minutes of crocodile tears. Then again with his fantasies, his hints about Arikina. His lies. One day you'll go too far, Mektu. One day you'll wish you hadn't pissed on everyone who tried to care. Hour after hour, they walk and shout. Condry is plagued with visions of their missing friends, parched and sunburned, throats too dry to swallow, to speak. Their own water supplies are so low, 4 fosca, maybe part of a 5th, that Condry can think of no way of managing his thirst but to refuse to feel it. But what will they do when they reach the others? How can they possibly make it to the rim? You won't face that problem, says a voice in his head, because you'll never find them. Shut up. Throwing darts in the darkness. You'll never see them again.
God's damn it!
Condry halts the others. He throws his pack on the ground and slips the bandage from his eyes. Blackness. Blurred shapes. A lamp seen through water. The moon. Ignoring Mektu's protests, he bends and gropes in his pack. Arrows. Matches. The medical kit. And within the latter, wrapped in goatskin, the glass bottle of wound spirits. He pulls the jar out, then takes the end of his bandage in his teeth and rips off a 3-foot length. He puts the bottle and the length of cloth in Mektu's hands.
Drench it, he says. What happened? Says Mektu. Did you cut your foot? Just hurry up. Says Condry.
He gives the matches to Eshet, who has also lifted her bandage. When Mektu has soaked the cloth, Khandri ties it tight to an arrow shaft. He looks at Eshet, who nods.
I'm ready, she says. Aim high.
Khandri knocks the arrow, points the bow skyward, draws. Eshet strikes a match. A great flame springs to life by Khandri's shoulder. He lets fly. The arrow streaks upward in a dazzling arc. 300 feet above the wasteland, it goes out.
Now look hard, pain or no pain, he says. Uncle Chindelin has a bow as well. He'll answer if he can.
Their eyes sweep the dark world, horizon to horizon. Minutes tick by, and the cold dread deepens in Khandri's chest.
Uncle's not the only one who might see that flare, says Mektu.
You have another idea? Says Khandri.
Mektu doesn't answer. They wait on, but the darkness is unbroken.
Do it again, Khandri, says Eshet. Do it until you run out of arrows.
Khandri shoulders his back.
Later, he says, too miserable to elaborate.
There are arrows aplenty, but the wound spirits will be exhausted much sooner. They walk another mile and climb the first of the hills before he sends a second flare into the sky. Again, there is no answer, and their shouts return only echoes. Khandri's mind ticks off the possibilities. The bow lost, the arrows lost, matches lost or soaked to uselessness. Nothing that burns like wound spirits in his uncle's possession. Or their faces turned away. Or their deaths already a fact. They descend the eastern slope of the hill and climb another, much taller, and from its barren crown he sees dawn in the east. He thinks, that dawn will kill them. Very soon, mere minutes from now, their flares will be invisible in the light. With great haste, they signal again. Mektu hisses a flat little tune through his teeth. Eshet's puffy eyes are on Khandri, imploring, and Mektu snaps at her.
Look for them, not at my brother!
His voice thick with heartbreak. Is there any torture like watching hope drain away? Water through your fingers? Dry despair on your tongue? Dawn spreads from the east. Khandri shoots a fourth and final time. He has smashed the bottle and swabbed it out with the rag. As they wait, barely breathing, Khandri glances over his shoulder. And there it is, the east rim. The sun is very clearly rising over a distant, jagged wall. It should have been a moment of joy, that first glimpse. The Lutaral is there. Water and food and caravansaries are there. He and Mektu and Eshet will not die in the Iskralem. They will go on, devastated, toward that heartless sun. In the Setapre, we almost worshipped you, Sumitra Sun Goddess. Look at my madness, talking to an ember in the sky. You took so long to climb above the coastal range. You gave us long, cool mornings for labor, for making love. She does not listen. She does not care. Here a man could come to hate you. And you know it, bitch. You're still stabbing at my eyes. Khandri turns away. A sputtering fire dances on a hilltop, 2 or 3 miles to the north. It waves fitfully in the half-light, 2 seconds at the very most, and dies. The brothers and Eshet roar as one, an appropriately hysterical sound, then fall dead silent, not daring to breathe. Over the dead hills, a living voice. Chindelin's.
Here's God. Eat.
Seconds later, they are racing northward down the hill. They have not understood the smith's words or stopped to worry about the fact, but the sounds reverberate in Khandri's thoughts until they sort themselves out. Tears and laughter burst from him, commingled.
We're fucking thirsty.
For one terrifying moment, they fear they have aimed for the wrong summit, lost their friends in this sea of once-drowned hills. Then a flash of sunlight on metal. It is Chindelin, atop the next ridge, signaling with the side of his axe. He comes reeling down the slope. They meet at the bottom and embrace. His eyes are sunken and his shriveled skin has a waxy sheen. Grinning, he takes the Fosca from Condry's hand.
"Finish it," says Condry.
"Just please be careful, Uncle. We can't afford to spill a drop." The smith takes only a mouthful, dribbling the water through lips like cicada skins. After swallowing with concentration, he speaks in a pained, dry whisper.
"Saved. One mouthful. So I could yell. Ong's tears. Glad to see you. Come on."
He leads them west around the hill, to a small escarpment where Talopeke lies sprawled on Chindelin's riding coat, a rough bandage covering her eyes. She is utterly motionless as they approach, but when the smith kneels and lifts her head, she frowns and starts to fight him.
"Shh, dear," says Chindelin. "They've found us. We're safe."
Her lips have dried together. Chindelin has to split them open with his fingers, like a rind. He whispers their story as she drinks. Talopeke's madness had carried her almost to the hills. Then her legs had collapsed. She had lain in the sun, screaming and thrashing a while, and finally slept. Chindelin, after taking away her knives, had dragged her on his riding coat through the worst heat of the afternoon. Up to that point, he had merely followed her voice. He was too blind even to make out the horizon. He prayed they were still making for the hills, where there would be some hope of shade. He had walked face first into cacti and stumbled into holes. He had heard the chirrup of a deadly Kayla lizard, a poison spitter, and felt a snake pass like the crack of a bullwhip across his boot.
"Then your flare. Couldn't answer. Had some arrows, but nothing. Wanted to burn."
"But you found something, finally," says Eshet. The smith nods, makes a chopping gesture, then points at Talopeke.
"Her braid. Oily. As a wick."
"I'll bet she loved you for that," says Mektu. Chindelin looks at Talopeke thoughtfully and rasps.
"Still delirious. Said they'd make fun of her. At school."
They drink the Foscas dry, lavishing water on the smith and Talopeke. The big hill provides shade until almost midday, and again from mid-afternoon until dusk. Then Condry climbs to the summit, and even without the telescope, he can see the lamps of villages along the rim. 5. Give your soul. After 6 hours, Utzing tired of the Yatra's teasing. He clapped his hands, and his priests lit a fire of silphium, and the demon hissed and rattled the window casings. Throwing them open, the emperor laughed. "How simple a matter it is to drive you off!" The demon fled the palace as a whirlwind, never to return, but its parting words echoed in the courtyard, and long in the mind of Utzing.
"Simple as well to cast a stone, prince of nations. But who may retrieve it from the sea?"
Annals of Utzing. Mektu is bringing water to the pigs. Condry, smoking under a persimmon tree, watches his advance across the blazing yard, the ghost-white farm dog padding at his heels. In the 4 days they have sheltered there, the animal has grown quite fond of Mektu, but bristles and growls at Condry himself. No justice. Condry even tossed it a chicken bone. The dog had shied from the offering, which later crossed the farmyard on the shoulders of ants. Chindelin, near the fence, is hacking at a stump with a splitting maul. The old woman who owns the farm is a war widow and somehow indebted to Talopeke. She asks nothing of them, but they mean to earn their keep. Condry leans back against the tree. Swallows, grasshoppers, a blossoming vine along the fence. How can it be that they are fugitives? How can the world have little places like this one, and legions of men who want them dead? Condry lifts his gaze. The little homestead crouches on the rim of the Iskralim, half a mile north of Mab Makutin, the city withering inside its imperial wall. He can see the whole of the dusty road to the northern gate, deserted, save for a few children kicking a ragball in the distance. No Eshet, no talupeke. He snuffs his cheroot against a rock and pockets the stub.
Damn the both of you. It's past noon. You promised to come back hours ago.
4 days since they crawled from the stolen sea. The first two given over entirely to sleep. This is the breather that Chindelin spoke of, that first day, while they still clung to the shade of the western cliff. But already, Condry worries that they have stayed too long. Yesterday, the women had set out for the city to bargain for the men's passage across the desert, and Eshet's as far as her village. The men had balked at the idea of sending them alone, but Eshet and Talupeke held firm. The last thing they wanted was an escort of deserters from the Army of Revelation.
"You want to protect us?" said Eshet. "Hide your damned tinted eyes."
And that makes sense. The eye stain would betray them to anyone close enough for a handshake. No one is safe in their company. Even the war widow had come close to turning them away. They have the mysterious stain-suppressing ointment from Garatajik's pack, but so little of it, and who can say when their lives might depend on such a trick? Nor do they fancy the ointment's burning and irritation, not in eyes still recovering from salt blindness. So the men had stayed behind, seething more than resting, while the women scoured the city. They had focused their efforts at the Dawn Gate, the east-facing gate, which, in addition to having some holy significance, was also the point from which all caravans set out.
"There's a market for travelers heading east, the Desert Market, they call it, just outside the wall,"
Talapeke had said.
"And the Dawn Gate brings good luck to everyone."
She glanced at Mektu.
"If you're respectful."
But the Dawn Gate, whatever it was, had brought no luck at all, and at noon they had returned discouraged. Passage for strangers in hiding? No one had wanted to discuss the matter. Today the women had set out at sunrise, steeled for a longer search.
"Someone will need the money," Condry thinks for the 100th time.
With the gold and rubies from Garatajik, they should be able to hire men to carry them on their shoulders. And then there is the Madaglin, a fortune in itself. No one contests Eshet's claim to the blade, but since the incident at the snakeskin, she has been muttering about that cursed weapon, and joking. Was she joking? Can she joke? About dropping it into a well. Condry is not about to let that happen, but what to do with the thing? Fence it here in Mab Makutin and hope it isn't recognized? Or carry it with them? Heavy, desperately hidden, a temptation beyond words, and pray that they are never searched. In any case, gold is clearly not enough. Desert caravans are not stagecoach services, apparently, and even a stagecoach driver will whip his horses past suspicious men on the roadside. What can the women be saying?
"God's peace, stranger. How far can you take us, and how soon? One of us is a Parthan. Will you pass close to her village? Will you ask no questions? Will you trust us and the men we haven't brought along?"
No, it can't be easy. But for the moment, all he wants is to see Eshet and Talupeke emerge from the road's shimmering heat. They had promised to return by mid-morning, and now his thoughts are full of dark conjectures. He rises, crosses the farmyard, wipes his feet by the kitchen door. Within the house, the light is dim. He moves to the corner of the main room, where the four of them has spread their bedrolls, and retrieves the telescope from his pack. Then he climbs the stairs to the rooftop terrace. The old woman, Yahita Chen, is hanging laundry along one wall. She smiles vaguely at him, her eyes clouded with cataracts.
"Don't you fear for them," she says. "That soldier girl of yours was trained by General Tabasa. She knows how to stay alive."
"I'm sure you're right, mother," says Condry, but his words are mere politeness. Talapeke's hints have made him wonder if the Great Black Hat himself is alive. He raises the telescope. Mab Makutin's imperial wall is vast and cold. Chindelin spoke of it as a ruin, but Condry can see no breach in the massive structure, only the occasional crumbled rampart or turret in disrepair. But he can see over the wall. Yahida's farm stands on a bluff, and Mab Makutin, the former port, straddles the lowest stretch of cliff for many miles. Dying or not, the city is strangely beautiful. There are barnacle-like clusters of tiny houses, smooth-walled and white and devoid of sharp corners, with round chimneys and windows like holes punched in dough. There are shops and tea-houses crowded with customers, teeming schoolyards, dogs basking in the sun. But between these brighter districts, looming over them, are crumbling halls and towers and warehouses built on an entirely different scale, the remains of the imperial city, wreckage from the time of kings. They stand shunned, these monstrous buildings. Tomb-like, they look down on the living city with dismay. And somewhere in that city, that ghost port, walk Eshet and Talipeke. Merciful Ong, what's keeping them? What danger have they landed in for us? But Ong has no comment, and Khandri sweeps the telescope to the east. The land is a fragile green. The rivers that fed the Iskralem are gone, but many thin, trickling streams still water the plain of the Lutaral. In the distance, Khandri spots antelope and wild buffalo, and farther yet, the steep Erig hills that form another sort of wall. Between this gentle country and the desert, Sumuridath Jal, the land that eats men. Will they lose the hunters in that inferno, or just their lives? Don't think about that. Study life while you can. Prancing colts in a barnyard half a mile away, carts heaped with winter oranges, red herons strung like jewels along a stream. And to the north, a bamboo watchtower. New built, soaring. Khandri frowns. Why place it there? What danger does Mab Makutin face from the north?
Mother, he calls to the old woman, how far off is the war front?
100 miles, give or take, she says. Your prophet's men are dug in north of Harul Makut, last I heard. Now get down from here before you're spotted. The women will be along.
Khandri descends to the farmyard. Chindalin is leaning on the splitting maul, soaked in sweat. Take a rest, says Khandri. I'll finish off that stump when the heat breaks.
That's what I told him, says Mektu,
emerging from the henhouse. Clutched awkwardly in his hands are 9 or 10 almond brown eggs. You'd do better with a skirt, says Khandri.
You'd do better with this egg up your ass.
Khandri giggles despite himself. The joke is less in the words than the voice Mektu has adopted, an uncanny impression of their mother, Diakra, who even at sword point would never say anything so vulgar.
Stop that, it's creepy, says Chindalin. How are those eyes of yours anyway? Still improving?
I found the eggs, didn't I?
Khandri lifts a corner of his brother's shirt. He winces. The spot where the arrow pierced Mektu's side is healing swiftly, but the exit wound is another matter, red and tight as a blister. Closest to the scar, red flesh gives way to yellow. Khandri's fingers, hovering over the wound, can sense the heat without touching it.
Charming, says his uncle. Something you can brag about with the ladies.
His tone is light, but when Khandri catches his eye, he knows Chindalin feels the same dread that he does. The wound is festering. Mektu needs a doctor. A real doctor, not some village sawbones with grimy fingernails. And that will be the end of secrecy, unless the doctor is as good a soul as this old woman. A growl. The dog has heard something on the road. Khandri turns and sees a man in ragged uniform, still far off but coming their way. It is one of the sentries from the tower.
What are they after now? Says Khandri. This morning it was sweet limes. Yesterday, too. They buy a lot of sweet limes.
I don't think we need to hide from those kids, says Mektu. They don't even come into the yard. If they're snooping, it's only because they're bored. You know what tower duty's like.
Don't assume they're harmless, says Chindalin. They serve at the pleasure of the Ursad of Mab Makutin, and he is a ruthless man. Tight-fisted, charming, murderous when necessary. He was a soldier, then a warlord, and then he seized Mab Makutin and made it his own private piggy bank. He's incredibly rich. They say he has a war elephant, and brings it out on special occasions to amaze the rabble. I don't know about the elephant, but I know he has spies, Every 10th man is a spy.
How long ago did you say you were here, Uncle? Says Mektu.
Don't call me Uncle. 11 years, maybe 12.
Maybe he's grown gentler with age, says Mektu.
Rubbish, says the smith.
That's what happens to some men. They get gentler, also slower and fat.
Chindelin looks daggers at him. The Ursad's a bit like that dog you're so fond of, he says. He can sit quietly, play favorites, keep watch on his little kingdom, or he can rip your throat out for looking at him cross-eyed, or because you look like a nice slab of meat. And who do you think tosses him the sweetest morsels? The prophet, that's who. You can bet your bread and butter that whatever his spies learn, her radiance learns soon enough. So get your asses into the house.
They know the drill. Close the shades, sit in silence at the table, wait for Yahida Chen to fetch whatever the sentry is buying, to lie again about her guests. Wool merchants, that is the story they have settled on, readying themselves for a journey by camel train, south to Sendu where wool is in demand. No, they'd prefer not to meet anyone. They're a bit timid, you see, a bit ashamed of their rags. The dog has slipped inside with them. It nudges Mektu, who smiles and scratches its ear. Condri's nails bite into his palm. If he is ashamed of anything, it is that he hasn't found Mektu a doctor. They had to rest, he tells himself. Even with the prophet seeking them everywhere, even knowing another wolf pack might ride out of the stolen sea. Their eyes had to heal, their burned skin recuperate, their dry flesh take on water. To light out into the desert otherwise would have been unthinkable. But for Mektu, lighting out untreated would be a death sentence. Late afternoon. Yahida Chen has stopped telling them not to worry. The men put on the anonymous clothes she provided, her dead husband's, presumably, and set out for Mab Makutin, surly and swift. The brothers have strapped their machetes across their backs, underneath their robes. Chindelin brings only a dagger. No wool merchant, he concedes reluctantly, ambles into town with a battle axe. The smith chatters as they walk, betraying his unease.
We'll start at the Dawn Gate, and that desert market. You two should see the gate anyway. It's a marvel. So old, even the Khosrajis couldn't say who built it when they came here 1,000 years back. They built it into their own wall, you see. Whatever fortification it was part of was gone, eradicated, but the old gates still sound. I passed through it myself with my garrison. I still see it in my dreams.
How close is the Great Desert, Uncle? Asks Mektu.
Chindelin turns his face to the wall of hills. Close enough to touch, he says. From the peaks of the Aregs, you look right down into its jaws, and you can't believe this green country can go on existing. It's like a baby snuggled up to a crocodile.
The heat is lifting, the road busy again. Peddlers and farmers pass in both directions, leading horses and camels, fodder tied in enormous bundles on their backs. Voices like a lazy river. Good day, brothers. On keep you. May fortune smile on your journey. The three men return the pleasantries, but keep their distance, hiding their eyes. They near the wall and the city's north-facing gate. This close, Condri can see the decay his uncle spoke of. The wall's great corbelled turrets are shedding their roof tiles. The iron gates are gnawed by rust. Still,
it's so damned huge. Chindelin nods. And this was the periphery of the empire, the lacy trim. Imagine the great cities at the height of Khosraji power. Imagine Khosralis to this day. Jashar, is that?
He points straight ahead at the city.
Ong's blood, lads, it's them.
Eshet and Talapeke are running out through the city gate, making straight for them. Mektu gropes for his machete, but Condri stops him with a wave.
Don't draw. No one's chasing them. Keep that blade out of sight.
The women skid to a halt before them.
What are you doing here? Hisses Eshet. Are you trying to ruin everything? Have you forgotten your eyes?
Have you forgotten what mid-morning means? Condri counters. What did you think? That we'd stay back there shooting marbles?
Something happened, says Talapeke.
I had to go somewhere fast. Well, then don't mention it.
Let her explain, boy, says Chindelin.
Since the Iskralim, he has become almost maddeningly tolerant of Talopeke's quirks.
Harach, we can't just stand here, says Eshet. And you can't pass through the gate until nightfall, or twilight, anyway.
They look around, awkward as hell, and at last spot a man with a two-wheeled food cart making for the gate. Pouncing on the startled fellow, they buy 5 lamb skewers, and crouch in a circle by the road's edge, gnawing like wolves.
Bad luck again, says Eshet through a mouthful. Only 3 caravans preparing for the desert.
How's that possible? Says Condri. I thought this was where they started.
Mab Makutin is the largest port of departure, says Talipeke, and winter's the best season for a crossing. But they're not crossing this year. They're afraid.
Of the desert?
Of course, says Eshet. If you don't fear the desert, you're as stupid as a cow. But this year, they're also afraid of the Darsunuk, the time of madness, remember? A Tau's men spoke of it. Today it was the camel drivers. A night of blood is coming, they said, and tears of fire from the gods, and senseless killing, neighbor against neighbor, clan against clan. It's a sweet little legend, the Darsunuk.
And is the white child part of that legend? Asks Mektu.
Both women start. Chindelin's response is closer to a gasp.
Of course not, says Eshet. What put that into your head?
Mektu shrugs.
I don't know. I just thought maybe.
Because it sounds awful, and the Darsunuk sounds awful?
Because people are afraid of it, says Mektu. People are afraid of all kinds of things, says Talipeke. I told you before, I'd never heard of the white child before those Rasanga brought it up.
But you have, thinks Condri, still looking at Chindelin. His uncle is shaken and trying hard not to show it.
What is this thing you're so afraid of, that the Rasanga are afraid of?
And why the fuck aren't you telling us everything? These days most of us don't believe in the time of madness, says Talipeke. But camel drivers are superstitious fools. They wouldn't even talk to us. They just waved us away. Or laughed, or tried to pinch us.
Pinch you? Says Mektu.
Hurrah! Those horny bastards! Let them try it when I'm around.
Actually, says Talipeke, it just happened once.
Condri smiles at her, but Talipeke shakes her head.
Don't look at me. It was Eshet who cracked that fucker's jaw.
She mimes a hard backward strike with an elbow.
Serves him right, the fool. You don't pinch a Parthen's ass.
I was the fool, to strike without looking, says Eshet. He could have been a nobleman. I might have been jailed. Fortunately, he was just a drunken pest.
Men laughed and started joking with us, and when they learned our business, they introduced us to the owner of a caravan, one of the few preparing for the desert. They were strange folk, nervous and not exactly friendly. They kept away from the others at the desert market. From the south, they said, and trying to get east to Shefidang.
They sound perfect, says Condri.
And you two look like someone pissed in your coffee, puts in Chindelin. What happened? They turned you down like the rest?
Oh, no, says Eshet. They're willing to take on passengers.
So what's the matter?
Talipeke gives a snorting laugh.
They're plain fucked, that's what. The mercenaries they hired for protection, they demanded half their pay up front, and as soon as it was in their pockets, they ran off down the smoke road.
I told the owner that you three would be their protection. That made him laugh. Come back when there are 30 of you, he said.
Condri's eyes widen.
30 guards?
30 soldiers, battle-tested, says Eshet. Or else they won't move an inch.
Pitfire, why so many? Asks Chindelin. They're crossing the empty desert, not Vajinland.
Empty desert, says Eshet, shaking her head. No Parthen would use those words.
Who the hell cares? Says Mektu. Finish the story. You did something. You had to get somewhere fast.
Talipeke smiles broadly. It is so unlike her usual range of expression that she seems almost to become another person. Ong's tears, thinks Condri. She's a 16-year-old girl.
We'll show you, says Talipeke.
and we don't even have to cut through Mab Makutin. We can follow the wall around to the market outside the Dawn Gate.
The desert market? Says Condry. You found someone, then?
Oh, she found someone, says Eshet.
They walk north, in the wall's growing shadow. Blackbirds flash overhead, dark leaves in a whirlwind. Atop the wall, the crenellations stand in decay, like rows of carious teeth. Grass and brush sprout between them. Condry thinks of the aqueduct back home. The guards above seem tiny and too few.
Never trust people, says Talopeke, as if for the first time. That's my weakness. That's what I do. One day I'll be killed because I've trusted again. I mean that. It's the way I will die.
Nobody knows how they'll die, sister, says Eshet.
If a god tells you, you know, says Talopeke.
Chindelin clears his throat. Tal and I talked quite a bit in the Iskralim, boys. Condry's mouth twitches. Tal. The massacre of her general's forces was an ambush. Someone betrayed them.
Someone inside Black Hat's ranks? Asks Condry.
Yes, says Talopeke. Someone deep inside. The general doesn't share his battle plans with many. Only senior officers would have known we were making for the Maghreb defile. I hope I'm the one who catches the traitor, whoever he is. I want to cut his feet off and watch him try to walk. I want to hold his gaze as he dies.
Who could such a traitor be working for? Asks Mektu.
How should I know? Everyone's betrayed us. The Ursad, who threw us out of Mab Makutin. The Loak royal family, who worship the prophet now. And the worst shit-eating pig of all, the Sartaf of Sendu. He was a Chiloto, but we trusted him. He called himself the last free prince, said he would fight the prophet to his last man. When he asked for contributions, my people paid. In cattle, in gold, and every year he asked for more.
But then the rumors began. Sendu wasn't fighting the prophet at all. They were in league, fighting together in southern lands. Of course, we stopped paying that pig of a Sartaf. He sent us presents, and a letter denying it all.
She picks her teeth with her empty lamb skewer. The letter, she says, ended with an invitation. Send your military commanders to Sendu. See the fighting for yourselves. Black Hat Tabassa, only a major then, smelled treachery and urged his superiors to refuse. But the letter guaranteed their safety and bore the Sartaf's royal seal. Days later, the entire Lutaral-Loak War Council rode for Sendupre, capital of Sendu, and never returned. Sendu abandoned all pretenses. It seized lands from the devastated Lutaral clans and mounted their leaders' heads on stakes. There was even a rumor that Chihalkra, the prophet's firstborn, had been waiting in Sendupre when the war council arrived.
But the Sartaf was no match for my general, says Talopeke.
A year after the killing, he led a shadow team right into Sendupre. They dressed as rag pickers, slept in the slums, and each day they kept watch on the Sartaf. Everyone he met, every festival and tavern and whore's den he visited, and one day...
This story's much too long, blurts Mektu. Be quiet, you ass, says Chindelin. Tell us what happened, Tal.
There were baths, says Talopeke, glaring at Mektu. For rich people, but poorly guarded all the same. The general and his team slipped in through the laundry and killed the Sartaf's men, and tied the pig himself hand and foot. General Tabassa took a brick from the fire where the bath water was heating, and wrote his name on it in charcoal, and took the brick to the Sartaf's skull. When he was done, he put the brick in the corpse's hands.
I did this to you, he said, but it is also true that you did it to yourself.
Then he led the whole assault team out of the baths and home from Sendupre, unharmed.
That's a fine story. Chindelin turns her a crooked smile. Didn't exactly change the world, though, did it? The Sartaf's nephew was crowned before the corpse was cold.
Talopeke glares at the smith.
He stopped advancing. He doesn't dare cross the general.
Who cares? Who cares?
Says Mektu, almost prancing with impatience.
All this old crap! What does it have to do with us?
Don't you understand? Telepeke's gaze moves to Mektu. He's coming, with all his forces. My general is coming here.